Well, hi. How are you? Great. Good to see you this morning. I'd like to thank the ladies for the special music. That was very beautiful. Thank you very much for taking the time to do that. Want to encourage you, as camp season is quickly approaching, to make sure you get your applications in. I'm sure by me saying this that they will all come in at the last minute, but that's okay. We'll still accept people. But I'd like to encourage you, if you are thinking of applying this year, to go ahead and to fill out an application. If you do not have one or you did not get the book, you can actually go to the UCG website and download a camp or a worker application. So over the next few years, we are going to go through a concerted effort to kind of ramp up camp and to add a few things that would give additional challenges. So if you've been coming year after year after year, and you know, you may think, well, you know, some of the same things I do over and over again. What we're going to do, and we're going to phase this in over the next few years, is to add a few things so that we can provide a challenge as you go up. And as you are at camp longer, we can give you a challenge to not only as a camper, but then a method so that we can also move, if you want to go the route of a worker, to be able to move off into that area. So if you're thinking of going to camp this year, I'd encourage you to go ahead and get your applications and download those and get those submitted. Now, you may not recognize me today because I don't have a PowerPoint. But I am the same person. But since it's the days of unleavened bread, I decided to come with an unleavened sermon today. So unleavened being one without a bloated PowerPoint. So that is what an unleavened sermon is. So that is what I'm presenting to you today. And how many of you during the past week actually found some bread in your house? How many found some? I did. I found some. We moved to a new house, and one of my kids, I think it was Cameron, was looking. There's a wood stove in the corner, which we obviously haven't used yet. And he went in there just the other day, and he opened up the wood stove, and there was a crusty piece of bread in there. Now, I don't know about you, but I usually use things like wood to burn as fuel in my wood stove. So, I mean, I could be off on that, but I usually use combustible materials when I want to burn something in a wood stove, so I never actually thought to go look in that wood stove to find bread. Well, there you go. But what we did, though, and this is a tip for you, is just shut the door, right, and seal it. Because if you think about it, it has a chimney that goes outside, so that bread is actually more outside than it is in my house, is kind of how I reasoned this week, so... Actually, that'll fit quite well with my sermon today. So, yes, so we put that leaven out of our house via the chimney. Christ issued a strong warning to us, actually to his disciples back in the day, and we heard part of that in the sermonette today by Mr. Gunderson when he talked about the leaven of the Pharisees and the doctrine of the Pharisees. Let's turn back to Luke 12, verse 1 through 3. Because there is quite a strong warning. Christ says something to beware of. He says to beware of it. And I think it's important for us to be able to understand why he says that and to realize that this is not a light statement. What he is saying when he says beware, it's not just another statement where he comes along and says, hey, look out for this or look out for that or make sure you say please and thank you. It is not on that level. When Christ says beware in this context, he is saying this is something that is quite serious for you to be able to understand. So let's read what he says there. Luke 12, verses 1 through 3 says, in the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together, so they trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. For there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever we have spoken in the dark will be heard in the light, and whatever you have spoken in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed on the housetops. So he's saying this to his disciples that there is something here, and if you pair this with the other scriptures, one Mr. Gunderson read, it actually adds to it, that the leaven or the yeast of the Pharisees that he's describing here is something that he terms as hypocrisy. He says, beware of this yeast or this leaven. And what they did based on the hypocrisy is formed a whole set of behaviors, doctrine, standards, as Mr. Gunderson said, of how to act in a hypocritical way. So beware of this leaven, beware of the doctrine that leads to, is what Christ is saying here. Now this is a strong warning that Christ is giving. And what we want to do today is to understand this hypocrisy, but I think we should understand it in a little bit of a different light, and really not just as we've thought of it in the past, but if we look at the dimensions of hypocrisy, we'll find that it is happens on a number of different levels in a number of different ways. Hypocrisy can manifest itself. And it's important for us as we end these days of unleavened bread to really have that firmly in mind in our own hearts, to spot where we might see one of these things popping up. And we'll explain why this is important. First off, if you look at the word hypocrisy in the Greek, I won't give you the number since that's not very helpful for you, but what is actually translated, it's translated hypocrisy a lot of times. It's also translated dissimulation. And if you look at the word dissimulation, that just means to hide something under a false appearance. So part of the definition of hypocrisy is to hide something. It's a deliberate hiding of something. It's also translated another way, or this is the same word that's used for the acting of a stage player. So that's actually a great description if you think about it, that another way to look at hypocrisy is as an actor. Now, if you think about this modern day, like in Hollywood, you know, sometimes you'll see a movie with a main character and, you know, that maybe they're completely brave and bold, or they're leading and they're people through war as a general. You come to associate that movie with that person, right? And you think, man, that person must be just brave and the biggest leader you've ever seen. But when you meet them in real life, they say all kinds of wacky statements in the press, don't they? And you realize, you know, that person doesn't know a thing about that, right? And that's a good example, because when you see someone's a hypocrite, it's a very convincing portrayal. They look like this is, you know, these people must be really something. So actor's a great definition. So we have part of the definition is to hide or to cover up something, and part of the definition then is to go out and to act or to put on an act for something. Now, if we look at the word hypocrisy in the Old Testament, it's also listed there. It's usually defined, or the word is hypocrite. And David used it in Psalms 26:4, which we won't turn to. He says, "I have not sat with idolatrous mortals, nor will I go with the hypocrites." And if we look at that word, too, in Hebrews, it is translated a number of different ways. You actually won't see the word hypocrite a lot of times, but you will see the description of what it's talking about translated in the Old Testament. It's always translated something like to a secret thing, or to conceal something, or to hide something, to be hidden. And you see this in a number of scriptures. I'll just quote a few of them to you. Leviticus 4:13 says, "Of Israel sinned through ignorance, and it be hid from the eyes of the assembly," is how it's translated. Leviticus 5:3 says, "If it be that a man is defiled withal, and it be hid from him, and he knows about it." So that word hypocrite is translated usually like that, something that is happening, and then something that is hid or concealed or covered up. So if we put the Old Testament and the New Testament together and get the intent of what this word is talking about, we find there's kind of three main things that are here. There's a covering up something, there's a hiding, and there's an acting. So if we think about hypocrisy, think about it kind of in those terms, and you'll see how this, as we go through the sermon, plays out with the different scriptures. There's a covering, there's a hiding, and there's an acting that's taking place with people who are playing hypocrisy or have hypocrisy. So why does he say beware? Is it really a big deal? Is this really something that we have to deal with today or not? I think sometimes we read this section here in the Bible and we say, you know what, those guys back then were pretty bad. You know, I could see the Pharisees, I could see all that they did, and if I was alive, boy, I would say, man, those guys are amazingly hypocrites. But you know what, the Bible was not written down, these words were not written down, were not available to the Pharisees at the time. Christ spoke them directly to them. But what he spoke was recorded down and written for us today. There, and if you look at a lot of what Christ weaves throughout the Gospels, is either a rebuking of hypocrisy or exposing of it, and then what the intent of God really wanted to say. If you go back and read a lot of what Christ said, he dealt a lot with this very issue. That was a big problem of the day, but it is left recorded for us today multiple times over in the different Gospels that are there. So this is something that Christ left a record for us to come today and said, beware, beware. And when he says the word beware, It's not meant in, hey, you know, go look in the congregation, point your finger, say, yep, I know that person. They are a hypocrite. I know them very well. I can't believe they're coming to church. And I can't believe that is not what the language beware means. Beware, if you look at the intent of what it's saying linguistically, it says put your mind to yourself and evaluate. If I'm kind of paraphrasing that, but beware means beware, you evaluate yourself and beware of this popping up in you. So when he says beware, he's not saying, oh, there's going to be lots of people around you, beware of that. He's saying you beware yourself. So when we're in the days of unleavened bread, this is a stern warning. And I think we'll see if you take hypocrisy and you carry it out to where it's going, you'll find that is a very devastating thing, both for you personally on a spiritual level, for an organization or a group, and for those around you. That hypocrisy is a very devastating thing and ends up at a certain place. Now, let's turn back very quickly to Genesis 3, verse 7 through 8, and go back to the beginning. Because Satan himself, being a hypocrite, hides what's really inside his heart and says one thing. Satan starts this. Satan speaks this way. Satan lives this way. And what he did is he spoke this to Adam and Eve, the very first humans, and said to them things that just were not true or were covered up or were hidden, weren't they? Satan was covering, hiding, and acting out something or acting. And he duped the first man and woman. Now, what happens? What happens when human beings start to see this or start to sin and see themselves? Genesis 3, verse 7 through 8 says, then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together, and they made themselves coverings. And then they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. Now, this is what human beings do when faced with a couple of things. You have a choice. They had a choice. Adam and Eve, what did they do? It says two things there. They covered and they hid. Okay, when we go back to the definition of what hypocrisy entails, there's a covering and there's a hiding. Right from the very beginning, when man was faced with the sin and seeing what they did and themselves, they covered themselves. You can say this is literally, but you know what they were also doing was spiritually, emotionally covering and hiding from their very God. This is when man faces a sin and sees what's inside and the ugliness that they have done, is a natural reaction, is to cover and to hide. And Adam and Eve started this from the very beginning. So what they were doing is they started down this path of covering what was inside, hiding, and then acting themselves. And we see that this is right from the very beginning, the way that mankind reacts. Now, there's a chapter in the Bible where Christ spends a lot of time on hypocrisy, and I would like to just step through and take the middle part of this chapter, because there's some very revealing dimensions to hypocrisy that Christ describes there. Now, if you think about it, there's a lot of chapters that we could say, hey, there's a love chapter in the Bible, you know, 1 Corinthians 13. There is a faith chapter, Hebrews 11. But where's the hypocrisy chapter? You can say the whole Bible, but tell me if you can guess where the hypocrisy chapter is. Well, I've put a label on that today. I'd say Matthew 23 is one of those chapters. There are a couple of other ones, but this is Matthew 23, if you can start turning there, is where Christ starts to dissect hypocrisy, what man did, what its effects are, and the different dimensions of it. And what I would like to cover out of this chapter are basically seven dimensions that Christ lists here of hypocrisy. In other words, when you look at hypocrisy, we can always think of it one way. Yeah, I've got something I'm hiding in my heart, and you know, I'm being a different way. But you know what? Christ takes hypocrisy and says, you know what? It manifests itself this way, and it manifests itself this way, and it manifests itself over here. There's a number of different dimensions. When you see hypocrisy come out, it looks like this. And he spent quite a bit of time describing what hypocrisy will look like when you see it come out in man. So let's start down in verse 11. And actually, verse 11 is a slight side note, which is just something to tuck in the back of your mind to think about. It says, but he who is greatest among you, Matthew 23:11, you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. something to tuck in your thinking that we won't explore too much in depth today. But what you'll find is that those who have hypocrisy do not like the concept of serving. They do not like the concept of serving unless it is something that, you know, they can go be seen by, or that you know, other people can recognize them for serving. In other words, a true servant's heart is not there. And what Christ brings out in a number of different places, he says that a true servant, someone who is a servant, is the opposite of this. And that's why he spent a lot of time on that. If you're a hypocrite, that is going to rile you up. You won't like that. You won't like the idea of foot washing. Can you think of an idea in the Bible of a Pharisee who did not like the idea of foot washing? That's listed in there. And what you'll find there is these things are counter to each other. So if you see yourself not really reacting correctly to serving truly from the true intent or wanting to be seen for it, that is a clue. That's one clue. But let's continue on, because Christ dissects seven different things here. Now, these are listed as woes. And each of these phrases here, starting in verse 13, he says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites," after every single one of these. So he is clearly defining a topic here. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Hypocrisy is a main topic that is going on here. Now, let's just stop for one second and say, well, I am not a Pharisee. I don't think like that. And you can probably say that in your mind, and you can look at these folks. But the point of this is that if you start down the path of hypocrisy and it is not checked, it is not rooted out, it is not dealt with, it will end up where the Pharisees ended up. Christ said to us, and in other places, Paul said, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. You may think that you can have a little bit of hypocrisy, and it's okay to go forward with that. Christ and Paul say a little bit of leaven leavens the entire lump. When that is taken out to its ultimate place, that will end up permeating you. And this is a description of people that are permeated through and through with hypocrisy, what hypocrisy is all about. So this is very much for us today to say, hey, if I start to see these things, this is a place where it could end up. So let's start in verse 13 and see the first dimension of what Christ brings out. He says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in." Now, Christ does not start with the softest statement of the bunch. Christ actually starts with the biggest statement that he could say, is to say to the hypocrites, number one, is you are not going to be there. And he says, not only that, but you are hindering those around you to even see the kingdom and to enter the kingdom. He levels a pretty significant blow right out of the gate. He's not starting very soft here, is he? He is saying, let's get something straight. First of all, you are not going to be there if this is describes you. So a hypocrite here, someone who is not really demonstrating what God is really about, but acting, covering things up, hiding, acting, and instituting what they did, is not going to be helping someone to see what Christ really is all about. And not only that, they're going to prevent other people from seeing the real God. What did Job say? My eye finally sees you. A hypocrite works the opposite of that, because what should be exposed and brought out and, you know, done away with, instead is what? Covered up, right? Hidden, covered, and you act out something. You act out something else. So you will never get to the place where you can actually see God and what his kingdom is about. Now, I've always thought, well, how can that be? That's a pretty, sounds pretty harsh. But hold your place here and turn to Matthew 7:21 very quickly. Matthew 7:21. Matthew 7, verse 21 and 23 is a scripture we all know. How could this happen? How could you be religious and get to the place where you don't make it into the kingdom? It says here, verse 21, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name?" In other words, we look like we are doing very religious things here. We look like we are doing what is your will. And Christ in 23 declared to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Now there's a key here. How does Christ know somebody? How does he know you? Christ does not look or see as a man sees. Christ looks on the heart. So when Christ looked into the heart of these people, he did not see himself reflected. So therefore he said, I don't know you. I do not recognize you. In other words, these were a people whose inside did not match the outside. The outside were doing all kinds of great big things, but the inside did not match, did not look like Christ. So Christ said, I do not recognize you. That is how Christ sees you. That is how, when it comes down to the end, that is how he will know who are his, that Christ is built completely inside of somebody. So God knows somebody from the inside out, not the outside in, if you think of it that way. So let's go back to Matthew 23. Matthew 23 and verse 14 and continue on. So the first thing is, you know what? They prevent people from seeing and they will not be there. Verse 14 says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore, you receive greater condemnation. So what was happening is they had these long, humble, righteous, you know, sounding prayers that were being offered up. And if you were there that in the day, you would say, wow, that person is completely dedicated. In fact, you would probably feel guilty. You'd say, you know, I'm so busy with life, and these people are just spending hours praying there over and over and over. But you know what Christ said? That's for pretense, for a show, right? But you, as a person, probably would have been wrapped up in that, saying, wow, these people are pretty zealous, aren't they? But what was happening is they would make long pretense of prayers, but on the other hand, they had a cold, mean streak that didn't think twice about devouring a widow's house, or in other words, not taking care of them. How do you devour a house? How do you devour somebody's house? There's a number of ways. If we want to think about it today, that would be if you stand by and not help somebody, or if you withhold money or a tithe or something that should go to those in need, that you could be guilty of devouring somebody's house who needs that. And instead, they would make themselves feel better by giving these long prayers. Christ said, that's for pretense, but you are devouring. On this other hand, you are missing the entire point, and you are not doing it. In another place, Christ condemns them where that when he says to support your father and mother, there is some money that they should have given to support their parents. But what they would do instead is they'd say, you know what, it's more righteous for me to give that to the temple or to as an offering. So they would not support their parents, and they would justify that by saying, I am giving this for the work or for for the temple. And they substituted one for the other, and Christ said, it's the same principle he's describing there, is they missed it. That's not what he's looking for. That is not what he wants. So the second thing that was happening here is that they would do this. They would have a long pretense, but on the other hand, they would miss the point. And what Christ says is pure and undefiled religion is to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction wasn't being done. That's why he calls it pure and undefiled. Pure and undefiled because if you think about it, and this will be a reoccurring theme, pure and undefiled and servant are matters of the inside of the heart. I can give money and do that kind of stuff all day long and not necessarily involve my heart. But the other is a matter of the heart inward. So we can pray all day, and sometimes it might make you feel better, but sometimes God wants you to act. God wants you to go help somebody lift a hand and lift the finger, which they weren't willing to do as well. God wants you to do that part. They were not willing to do that. 15, if we go on to 15, it says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he's won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourself. So one of the things that they did is they would go and tenaciously recruit people to be like themselves, to have a gang and a community of people that were like themselves. But when you bring somebody in under this principle where it's all about show, and it's all about what you look like and what level you're at and how righteous you are, you're only going to end up trying to one-up each other. You're only going to end up trying to outperform your master, right? I am more righteous than him. His phylacteries are this broad. Mine are this broad, right? It doesn't stop. And what you find is, as the proselytes came, they would make the person twice as bad as they were, just by the nature of what it's talking about here. And if you want to think about it too, like in Star Wars, actually don't use Star Wars in my sermons pretty much ever, but like in Star Wars, if you think about Anakin Skywalker, who had some hidden things in his heart, was recruited by the dark side, and what he ended up becoming was twice the bad guy as his predecessor. You know, it's the same type of a theme that's there. So one of the things that follows this is that people that follow start to even do it twice as much and twice as worse. So 16, Christ brings out another dimension to hypocrisy. It says, "Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he's obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." So that can be slightly confusing what was going on there. But basically, what they would do is they would say, if I swear by this part of the temple, then I'm bound by it. If I swear by this part of the temple, you know what, I can be loosed from that. In essence, what they would do is they would make a promise. And what an oath is here, or a swearing, is that you invoke the name of a god or a deity to back up your claim. You say, oh, this person backs up, you know, what I'm saying basically here. Now, what in essence they would do then is, if they wanted to get out of something, they would swear by this part of the temple. Therefore, they could retract their word later. In other words, this was a very convoluted way for them to get away with a lie. Think of it like that. And you know what? They felt justified in that. They said, if I'm swearing by this part of the temple, I can back out. And this one, oh, you know. And so they would pick appropriately what they were thinking. I'm swearing by this part of the temple, and then later they'd back out of it. They were lying. Very elaborate scheme to end up with a place where they were lying. Christ says later, or in Matthew 5:34, I won't turn, he says, don't swear at all. He says, just stop this type of thing altogether. So let's continue on in verse 23. Christ brings out another dimension. He says, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. So this is another thing that follows hypocrisy. Again, what I'm identifying here are where hypocrisy leads to and the type of things and how it manifests itself. This is one of those ways. What happened here, if you look at what he's comparing, one of these things he says that you should have done is justice, mercy, and faith. Think about that again. What are those matters of? Justice, mercy, and faith are matters of the heart. Right, those are matters of the inside in the heart. Now, what they did, though, was something that they could do externally, really without thinking about it. You know, they took their herbs that were there, and they would, you know, divide it off and give a tenth of that. Now, you can do that, but you don't really have to involve your heart. And so what we find happening here is another key thing that happens with hypocrisy is there is an external substitute for something that should be happening internally. Let me say that again. There's an external substitution that takes place for something that should be happening internally. In other words, that they should have been dealing with their heart on these issues of the law, but when they took a look at that, what did they do? They covered it, they hid it, and they acted out by saying, I am doing these spices over here. Now, this is a key point of hypocrisy because we all face this, and we all face it different ways. In the sense that at some point in your life, you will get to the place where there's something in your heart you know you have to deal with. There's something that you know might be ugly. There's something that you know might be painful. There's something that you know that is there. And you have a choice in that circumstance of what to do. One choice leads you down closer to a path of hypocrisy and another choice leads you down a path closer to God. Taking those issues of the heart, and you know you see them, and covering and hiding, and then instituting something externally to make yourself feel better is what this is describing. Again, a substitution has taken place. Something that should and needs to be addressed on the inside is replaced with something that is happening on the outside. Now, this is a powerful thing, though. Rituals to human beings can be quite powerful. On a lot of my travels through work, through Europe, one of my favorite things to do was to go visit all of the cathedrals that are out there. You know, the buildings that men have built that, you know, take 150 years to build, that are just incredibly massive. It's just amazing piece of work. Now, I was sitting in one of these cathedrals once, and they started up one of their ceremonies. And you know what? It was very quiet. And you know what? It was very disciplined. And the people were very, you know, much into that. And it was very a solemn occasion. And you know what? You feel kind of pulled into that. You say, wow, that's an amazing feeling. The problem happens is, and there are rituals that God says for us to do, and there are at times, but the problem was that replaced and became the focus for what should have been happening on the inside. You can feel better doing a ritual all day long. You can feel great. And you can go from ritual to ritual to ritual and never address what's in your heart. That's where they were. That's exactly where the Pharisees were. And if people back then saw them, you would be wrapped up into it. The general masses of people thought these were amazing people, very righteous, very, very solemn, very righteous people doing amazing things. But Christ went and said, no, you are a hypocrite. This is not right. And let's go on to 25. He brings out another thing and says to them, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and dish, but the inside are full of extortion and self-indulgence. And he gives the prescription of what to do. He says it there. He says, blind Pharisees, first clean the inside of the cup of the dish, that the outside may be clean also. It's not an either or. It's not an either or, but the proper sequence is clean the inside, and that outside will become clean. They had skipped the inside and were only doing the outside. There was a substitution externally for something that should have been taking place internally. This is something for us personally to think about and to stop and think. Is there something in my life? You know what I think? What we probably run into a lot of times is we run into things that are just too painful, that we do over and over again, that we have no clue how to get out of. We don't know what to do about them. But if we go the route where we cover, hide, and start to act out other things, you're in danger of this path. You're in danger of that path. So you have a decision when you're faced those things, and we'll get to what the proper response is a little bit later. So they had stopped focusing inward, and they started focusing outward. And 27 says, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, for you're like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautifully outward, but inside are full of dead man's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Now, this is another thing that Christ says about these folks, is that it actually results in lawlessness. You would think that they were keeping the law to the nth degree, but they were declared lawless people. That's quite amazing. That would have been, you know, incredibly offensive to them, to the point where they would get really mad, which they did, and they killed the very Christ. But what he says here is they're like a whitewashed tomb. So what's a whitewashed tomb? And during the time of year before Passover, what they would do is they would go whitewash the graves that were out there. So that you could see them and be aware not to brush up against them, walk over them, because if you did, you became ceremonially defiled if you touched a grave. So they would whitewash the tomb so you could see them and avoid them. And Christ used the analogy of what they do during this time of year, during the Passover season, to say, you are like the whitewashed tomb. Have you ever heard of the term dead man walking? You know, if there's someone who's on death row in prison, and they get up to walk to the electric chair, they are declared a dead man walking because they're as good as dead. They're on their way. They're a dead man walking. That's what's said. In essence, if we rephrase it to today's words, Christ is saying, you are a dead man walking. You're dead man walking. You are like the whitewashed tomb, but inside you're full of dead man's bones, is what he said. So that is another aspect here, is that you may appear a certain way on the outside, but inside you're full of dead man's bones. And verse 29, the last part of it, says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. This was just a little too much, because what they would do is the prophets from the past years, who their forefathers killed, they would dress up the tombs and say, oh, you are our forefathers. You know, they would honor them in death. And then they would say, if we lived back then, I would never have done that. You know, it's very ironic because, you know, those people were God's servants and Christ-like, but the very Christ was in front of them. And they killed him. It's a very ironic statement that they're saying. They're saying, if I lived, I wouldn't have done that. But they killed the very Christ who lived in perfection on the earth. Now, I ask you again, is this a serious topic? And I don't mean to sound, you know, so heavy on this day, but I think the more I look into this, Christ says beware for a reason. Because when this starts to infiltrate, this is actually where it ends up taken in its full measure and its full course. Now we can say, well, you know, obviously that was back in that day. But you know what? I would put it out to you that I don't think it's over yet, and I think that we should think about this a little bit differently too. You know, I think if hypocrisy can flourish, that I think when we get to persecution in the end time, we always think that it might come externally, but I think you can think about this if it's permeated people, then they will think they're doing the right thing by potentially turning you in. Like it says, they think, you know, they will kill you thinking they do God a favor. How do you get to that point? It's described here. Actually, hypocrisy leads to this place where you take a look at those who are truly Christ's, Christ-like in the very Christ, and you put them to death. That's where it ends up. So Christ is pulling no punches here when he describes this. And I think that we should take his admonition where he says, beware, very seriously, you know, and say, well, this isn't me, but if we think about this in our hearts, hypocrisy undealt with can potentially lead to this place. And you may not understand that completely, but this is what Christ described, the dimensions of hypocrisy. You're not getting in, you do all these things, and you end up killing those who are God's. Those are pretty powerful words spoken by Christ about hypocrisy. So therefore, he says, beware. Beware of this. You watch for this in your heart. Now, another form of hypocrisy, I'll cover very quickly, that kind of manifests itself is the way of just being passive-aggressive. Passive-aggressive language, right? And basically, you know, I think different places breed this more than others. But passive-aggressiveness, if you think about it, language and methodology is just that, where you have something else in your heart, but outward you say something. You know, and I've heard this a lot of different ways. I've said it myself, and I do it myself. Or I'll say, you know, I have your best interest at heart, and I think you should do this. When really, that's not the case. You maybe just want somebody to do something your way. You're not really thinking about them, but we mix this language. It sounds so good, but underneath is something different. Right? If you think about that, passive-aggressive behavior is a form of this. Turn to Mark 12:13. Mark 12:13, Christ had people talk to him this way. Christ had people deal with him in this passive-aggressive mode with this language, this very thing. Mark 12. Mark 12 and verse 13. It says, then they sent to him some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to catch him in his words. It's described right there what was in their heart. What's in their heart? They want to trip him up. What did they portray themselves as? They said to him, when they came to him, they said, "Teacher, we know that you are true. You care about no one, for you do not regard the persons of men, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" I mean, you can almost hear this syrupy kind of language where they're buttering up Christ. They're sent to trip him up, but they're saying to him, "You know, we know that you're true. We know you're the teacher. We know this, and please teach us, O teacher." Okay, this is a complete miss. The inside and the outside are not matched up here. And they were using this passive-aggressive type language on him. And what did Christ say? He said that he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, "Why do you test me? Bring me a denarius that I may see it." So they brought it. And he said, "Whose image is on it?" And he said, "Render to Caesar what's Caesar's." And they marveled at him. Why did they marvel? I think there's two reasons they marveled. One is the answer he gave them, right? Wow, that's a very wise answer. Do you know why else they marveled? Because Christ saw right through them. These people talked like this to everybody of the day, and the whole assembly of people fell for it. Everybody went along thinking these guys really had their best interests at heart and were asking for the right reason. They marveled because Christ saw right through it and said, "You're a hypocrite in what you're saying." They marveled at both his answer and that he exposed them, which is amazing. So how did he expose them? What was it about Christ that he was able to see through this? This is another key thing to understand here about hypocrisy. I'll only quote 1 Peter 2, verse 22. It says, "Who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth." Christ, through and through, top to bottom, had no mismatch inside and outside. No deceit, no guile, as it said in other places. Christ himself, because he was not hypocritical, could see through hypocrisy. The opposite is true. If you harbor hypocrisy, you will be duped by hypocrisy. You may think that you're sophisticated, but if you harbor this in your heart, you will not be able to see it when it's in front of you, and you have a chance of being duped by it. Christ clearly saw through it, cut right through it, and said, "I see exactly what you're doing." So another important point is, if we have it in our heart and we don't deal with it, then it's possible when it comes along for us to be duped ourselves by it. Now, this language is addressed in James 5:12. James 5:12. If we could turn to James 5:12. Our language becomes a part of the solution here. It's not the only thing, but there is a big part of the solution in how we talk, how we address. Basically, if you think about it, are we honest? Are we honest? James says here, "But above all, brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment." Sometimes we read that and say, okay, that just says I have to walk around and say yes and no. And that's not what it's saying. You know, somebody comes up to me and says, "Do you hate me?" "Yes." "Do these pants make me look fat?" "Yes." I mean, no. You know, is that saying here, the only things that we're supposed to say when somebody asks you something is yes or no? It's not what it says. It says, when you say yes, let it be yes. When you say no, let it be no. In other words, don't let your yes be no. It should match. When you speak, be honest with your words. Do not harbor something different in your heart. And this is not saying you go around telling everybody you hate them and just telling them what's on your mind. With wisdom, and when you speak to somebody, you speak honestly. Your yes really means yes. Your no really means no. That's what it's saying there. Or whatever word you speak really means what you speak. Your integrity is intact. Your integrity is there of your heart, and it matches up. So the language becomes an important thing here, dealing with the passive aggressiveness. And Christ said the same thing in Matthew 5:37. I'll just quote. He says, "But let your yes be yes and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." Christ doesn't pull any punches there. Satan talks where his yes is no and his no is yes. And God says, when you are not honest and clear, you're in danger, because that source is from Satan, the devil himself, is where that comes from. You're in danger of that, and he is the father of hypocrisy. What does he present himself as? An angel of light. How opposite of what he is that? Okay, hypocrisy's father is Satan. His speech is that way. God says, when you say yes, Christ did not answer sometimes, did he? He didn't say anything. But when he did answer, he was very clear. Look at his example in the Bible if you want to see what he means by that. We don't always have to answer, but when we do, we need to be clear with it. So what we find here is hypocrisy is something Christ identified. And go back and read Matthew 5, 6, and 7 at some point in time, and you'll see that he addresses this over and over and over again and what the proper intent is. So if hypocrisy is something we need to look out for, what is the opposite? What is God looking for? What does God want us to be? What is the simple answer to this? What is the simple answer to this? What God is looking for, if I chose one word, would be authenticity. Authentic. You are authentic. You are not an actor. You are not faking it. God is looking for authenticity. And you know what? He's asked this down through the ages of all of his servants. He says, are you real? Are you real? Are you genuine? Are you authentic? He asked Abraham, who said he was trusted in God, are you authentic about that in your heart? And he went through the point of almost killing his son, and God said, I know. He asked Abraham if he was authentic, and Abraham was authentic. He asked ancient Israel, what's in your heart? I will lead you down here to see what's in your heart. Are you authentic? You know what? They weren't. Down through the ages, he has asked his servants, are you authentic? Let's turn to Matthew 26, 31, where he asks this of Peter. He asked Peter, are you authentic, Peter? Matthew 26, verse 31. Matthew 26 and verse 31. This is before Jesus was taken. It says, Jesus said to them, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. Peter answered him, and he said, what did Peter say? Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. Oh, he was very dogmatic about it. Even if all these people standing around you are made to stumble, I will never stumble. Christ said, I know what's in your heart and what will prevent you from standing with me tonight. And he said, assuredly I say to you, this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. He said, three times. He said, I know what's in your heart and that you will not stand with me. I know that right now you are not genuine. You are not authentic, and you will not stand with me. Peter, what did he say? Even louder, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. I mean, he is just raised up on his haunches and saying, I will never, ever do that. And so said all the other disciples. Peter was so certain he was genuine, there was no way that he would deny Christ. He was not really looking at what was in his heart, and he was not admitting it. What happened in Matthew, down in Matthew 26, 73, turn to 73, later on that evening, it says, and a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you. Then he began to curse and to swear, saying, I do not know that man. In other words, he is compounding sin upon sin here. He's letting it fly out of his mouth. He's swearing. He is completely out of control here. This is the third time, by the way, I'm breaking in the middle. Immediately a rooster crowed, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus Christ that had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So he went out and wept bitterly. Why did he weep bitterly? Why did he weep bitterly? Two things. Obviously, he just denied the Christ. But there is not a more bitter cry of someone when you see what you really are. And what happened here is that Peter saw what he was really about. And that is why he wept bitterly. He saw the discrepancy that was in his heart, even though he proclaimed it wasn't there. He saw it. He saw what was there. And if you turn over to John 21:15, we'll see a follow-up to this. John 21:15, Christ asked Peter a second time, are you genuine? Are you genuine or not? Are you real? Are you authentic? Look how Peter answered this time. So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to them, feed my lambs. And he said to him again a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. Now let me ask you this. Do you think he asked him three times or just out of randomness? What did he do to Christ before? He denied him three times. Do you think that Christ was not coming back to Peter and bringing this point home to him by asking him three times, based on the three times he had rejected Christ, he's asking him again. Let me ask you three times, Peter. And you know what was going through Peter's mind? Oh boy, the three times he rejected the Christ. This is not by accident. Christ knew what to say to Peter, and he asked him three times. And look how Peter answers again. He said to him a third time, 17, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And Peter was grieved, because he knew. Peter knew. And you know what? He didn't answer him exactly on his haunches. He wasn't standing up. He said, Lord, you know that I love you. There is a different response there with Peter. The second time when God asked him, are you genuine? And I think when we go through the days of unleavened bread and we say, yes, I've done this. Yes, I know this. Yes, I'm okay. We stand up on our haunches like Peter the first time and we say, yes, yes, I know it. But Christ is asking you the very same question. Are you genuine? And I would respectfully submit that we answer like, and think about it, and answer like Peter the second time, not the first time. That we would not declare how much we do know, and what we are, and how great everything is that we know, but we say, you know, Lord, you know my heart. You know me. We should answer, and we should answer like he did the second time. There was a change in this man. Christ deliberately brought him through the three times of denial and then the three questions here. And I guarantee you, Peter never lost that lesson for the rest of his life. That went so deep to him, and he said, you know what? The last time I declared I was genuine, I was seen to be a fraud. This time, I'm going to trust what Christ says, and I'm going to follow it, and I'm going to say, you know my heart. You know. I would suggest that we think about answering that way. Turn to 1 John 1, verse 8 through 10. Two scriptures that are the answer. Two scriptures to conclude with, and two scriptures that are the answer to this. You know, Christ already knows your heart. Christ already knows what's there. He's asking you, are you genuine? What does he say for us to do? 1 John 1, verse 8 through 10. If we say that we have no sin, Peter, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we say that we have not sinned, we make him a liar, and his word is not in us. If truth is not in you, what is? A game, hypocrisy, which is not the truth. The key here, like I said before, when you are faced with yourself and a sin, you have a choice. The choice is, who is going to cover that sin? Who? Will you cover the sin? Will you hide it? Will you act? Or will you admit, confess that sin to God and let Him cover it? But it keeps happening. 1,000 times you confess to God, you let Him cover the sin. As soon as you start covering, hiding yourself, and acting out, you're going down the path of hypocrisy. That's why it says here, if we admit we don't have sin, we deceive ourselves. But if we confess it, He's quick to forgive and cleanse you of it. If you hide it, cover it up, and act, it won't go away. You will have that forever. If you keep confessing that to God, no matter how long it takes, He will cleanse you of that sin. He will cleanse you of that sin. David said this another way. He said, you desire truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden parts you will make me to know wisdom. David said, inside me, I don't know, but you do. I confess, help me to see what's hidden. He wanted to address the things he didn't even know about that he wasn't covering, that he was covering up. He didn't even know. And then what's the second half of that? We must confess, and our choice is who covers our sin over and over again, God or yourself. You cover, your hypocrisy. God covers, you're going down a path where He will heal you. James 5:16 is the flip side of this. James 5:16 says, we have another confession here. Confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Confess to God. What do you do when you come to church? What do you do when you come to church? I think a lot of times we cover, we hide, and we act. And God says, confess your trespasses to one another. Ouch, that's hard. That's very hard. Do you walk around and tell everybody that you just are a miserable wreck? No. Why don't you start with somebody you know spiritually, you trust? But if we always hide and we always cover, what are we going to breed is not an openness, but a closeness. And we actually breed hypocrisy, don't we? You know, if we're not very open, and I always hear this phrase too, the church needs to become open. You know what? Again, that's substituting something on the outside that should be taking place on the inside. No, I need to become open. I need to become open. I need to confess. I need to ask, you know, for your prayers. I need to ask for, you know, for help in time of need. And it says that effective prayer of a righteous man will avail much. That can help you out tremendously. But if we stay covered, hiding, and acting, then we end up just walking around and breeding this in a group because of that one person. So take it on yourself as a one person to start this process. It's hard sometimes to be open, but it's imperative. And this is the counter to hypocrisy. Those two things. Confess that to God so that He covers it, not you. And then confess it to others so they pray for you and you can be helped. When we get to that place, hypocrisy becomes much less. Our openness becomes much more. And you know what happens? The truth can penetrate those hard-to-reach places. The truth actually gets in. And when we get to the end of the times, Christ says, you know, I recognize you. I recognize my character in you. He doesn't say, I don't know who you are, because you're acting. He says, I recognize you. So when Christ says at this point in time, beware of hypocrisy, He says that for a reason. He says He's looking for people to worship Him in spirit and in truth, not in hypocrisy and acting. That is what Christ is looking for. So as we go and we finish these days up, let's take Christ's warning to heart. where he says, you beware of yourself, inside yourself. And let's put that out. Let's examine our hearts and not answer like Peter did the first time and say, you know what, I know it. Let's stop and think about that. And let's really examine, confess to God so that he can cover, not us, and we can confess to each other and we can pray for one another.